This podcast is sponsored by Great White Hot Sauce. It's a small batch, handmade hot sauce made specially for you. So if you like hot sauce, you'll love Great White Hot Sauce. It's the hot sauce that bites back. Find it at www.trygreatwhite.com. Well, it's that time again. Time for another mixtape show. You know, those are the shows we talk about a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Pick up some lost information from past episodes. And we do Jack's favorite segment, This Day in Music. But I do that every week because I know it bothers Jack. And that's always fun. Bothering Jack.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
The KOFB studio presents Milk Crates and Turntables, a music discussion podcast hosted by Scott McLean with his co-host, Jack Calabrese. Now, let's talk music. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the podcast. Thank you, Amanda, for that wonderful introduction, as usual. Well, you know the name of it. I'm not going to say it, but thank you for listening and thanks for watching. We're live streaming right now over YouTube and Facebook. If you want to find us and you're on Facebook or you're just listening on whatever Okay, let's start that again. If you're listening over whatever podcast platform you might be on and you're interested in seeing what Jack and I look like, see, I was proper English. I was going to say me and Jack, right? Technically, that's not proper. It's Jack and I, okay? Here's your English lesson for the day. You can find us on the Milk Crates and Turntables channel on YouTube. If you want to get in touch with us, you can contact us at milkcratesandturntables@gmail.com. And I want to say right up front, thank you for listening. If you like the podcast, share it, give it a rating, leave a comment on whatever podcast platform. Those are called plumes, by the way, in the podcast universe. Yeah. Okay. So tonight's a mixed tape episode, which is, like the introduction said, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So without further ado, let's bring in my co-host, the man who gets mixed up on his times, or he's just mixed up in general, or he's a mixed can of nuts. Or, well, anyways, Jack Calabrese.
Hey, I'm not mixed up at all. I had to do
that's
the dishes
debatable
before I came up here.
That's you had to do the dishes.
I got chores, you know? I can't just, you know.
Can't well, I'm retired, so I'm officially a house husband. I have all day to do my chores.
Yeah, well, you know, I can't make the Miss Deb mad.
No. Miss Deb, I don't see that. Oh. I like Dr. Vera, I don't. Really?
Ooh. Well, I would get grounded and not be allowed to do the podcast. 2 weeks.
I'd have to have no the podcast. King. The king would have to call Miss Deb and negotiate with her. hard negotiations.
No, playing hardball. No. You don't want to make the Miss Deb mad.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Vera is a very pleasant and easygoing, but I keep her that way by cooking dinner for her every night. So,
I'm
retired. Did I tell you that I'm retired?
Yes. I'm very happy that you're retired, and I long to follow you.
Well, you're on your way, buddy. You're not that far.
Yeah, I got a couple of years. Got a couple of years, but you know, getting a little bit closer.
Good for you. So, hey, listen.
It's in the stars at some point, you know, which is better than not at all. I certainly.
Then there's no light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah.
I get plenty of friends that are like, "Look, I'm going to work until the day I drop," which may be tomorrow.
And that's, hey, listen. God bless them. That's what I say. God bless them. I was just fortunate. So something interesting today. I was a guest on another podcast.
As a member of Milk Crates and Turntables?
Well, no, but in the podcast world, when you do a crossover, usually, you know, they plug your podcast and then I plug theirs. But this was a podcast called True Hauntings and Scary Stories with Cynthia Sayre. Cool. Wonderful, wonderful lady. Yeah, very cool. Very, very cool lady. I had a couple of ghost stories to tell from when I was in the military. One, I actually saw a ghost. And the other one, I lived in a haunted house in Sacramento at Mather Air Force Base.
So can
we go temporarily haunted.
So did you really see a ghost?
I did. And I will tell you the story one day. I don't want to confuse it on this show, but it's pretty creepy, dude. It's pretty creepy.
I think it's a damn shame that our listeners are not going to be able to hear this story, especially since you've already kind of teased it.
They tune in to listen to a music podcast, right?
No, they tune in to listen to you.
No, well,
I
do get a lot of fan mail.
Charm. Absolutely.
On the milkcratesandturntables@gmail.com. I do get a lot of fan mail. And you get yours, but I just don't give it to you. So because I
can't. You are on a raft of fan mail floating in a sea of hot sauce.
Remember, when you control the email, you control the information.
You control. No, see, you forgot. You forgot the negative space.
Oh, well, I mean.
When you control the email, you control information.
Okay.
See?
There you go.
See the difference? What are we?
7 minutes in and you're already correcting me. That might be a record for you. That might be the longest time you've taken without. Well, real quick. So I was stationed as a canine officer, a canine handler in Clark Air Base in the Philippines. And in 1978, there was a dog handler there that got killed. He chased the cardinal rule was you don't chase intruders. And canine handlers only worked at night in the Philippines. Because of the heat during the day. And intruders are people that consider they're locals. They come on base illegally. They climb the wall. They climb the fence. They come on to steal stuff or destroy stuff or sometimes sabotage stuff. We weren't always liked by everybody there, but it's also a third world country. It's in better shape now than it was in 1988, 87. Well, this canine handler went into what they call the elephant grass, which is about, I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's elephant grass is like 10 feet tall. It's almost like being in a cornfield, except it's more dense. So this guy unfortunately broke the cardinal rule and he went after some intruders on his own with his dog. Well, one of the intruders circled back and stabbed this guy to death and got his gun and shot his dog. The dog lived, but unfortunately the handler had died. So I was out on post one night and you kind of heard the story when you get there, but you don't really pay much attention to it. But I'm out on post one night. It's like 3 a.m. and on every post that we had as canine handlers, and we were by ourselves and we patrol sometimes a 2 mile by 2 mile area, which is elephant grass, banana trees, some type of maybe jungle type of environment. And then we have the flight line, which is what we're protecting, which has all the, you know, the jets and the planes in there, the hangars. So I'm in this area, and we have these DOD guards, these guys that are, they're locals, they're Filipinos, and they have these green uniforms on, and they're kind of thrown in. They sit, they're at a static post. They're in these booths that look like ticket booths with no windows and no door. So it's like a 3-quarter box with a roof. And so I decided it's like 3 a.m. and I'm tired because you get out there and you patrol. And I sit up again and I tell this guy, I said, in Tagalog, Patiko means friend. I go, Patiko, I'm going to sit here for a minute. I'm just going to chill. If you see anyone coming, any cars, headlights, then let me know because I might doze off. Okay, boss. Okay, boss. So at the end of this area that I was at, you go into this valley called the Bam Bam or the Washout. And it's this giant, it's a big valley, not a valley per se, but it's a like a big crack in the middle of the base. And it's probably, I don't know how wide, but it's miles long. And that's where it gets a little hairy in there. And I mean, a lot of creepy crawly snakes, spiders, just all sorts of good stuff in there. And intruders, that was one of their best ways to get in. So right on the edge of the when you walk into this, what we call the Bam Bam, is this building. It's called Middle Marker. It's like 15 by 15 square. It's just the weirdest building. And it's got, when you open the door, it's got this big cement block in the middle of it, probably 2.5 feet high, just square, probably 6 by 6 square. For whatever reason, we don't know. That's the only thing in there. So when you look at the building head on, the top front right corner has a light. Once you walk past that, you go about 15 feet. Now you dip down and you go into the Bam Bam. That's where the, you know, a lot of action can happen, and it's dangerous in there. And so I sit up against this guy's gate shack, and I got my dog, and I got my GA, my ground assault unit. It's an M16 with a collapsible stock, and I just kind of doze off. And all of a sudden I wake up. It's probably like 7 minutes, I think. And I look over at that building, and standing under the light is another canine handler with the dog. To the point where I looked at him, I said, "Hey, what's up, dude?" Like, just so he didn't think I was sleeping, right? I was like, "What's up, man? What's up?" And then I look at the guy, the guy, I said, "I thought I told you to tell me if you saw somebody." He goes, "Boss, I don't see anybody." I look back, dude's gone. Gone. This dude was standing there clear as day in front of me, not 40 feet away, right under the light, him and a dog, a German Shepherd. Just standing there. And I know the patrols that go into the Bam Bam, it's always a two-man patrol, two canine handlers. So you have two land sharks at the end of a leash. And I was a little freaked out. I was like, And then I talked to my buddy after work, after shift. I said, "Dude, I saw something, you know," and he said that was probably, and I don't want to say the guy's name. So I'm like, he goes, "Because that's where he got killed, over in that area." And I was like, "Well, I saw the dude."
The dogs have been fed.
Okay, everybody. Jack just announced the dogs have been fed. Thank you.
Miss Deb just popped in.
I saw that. So I.
So wait a minute. Back up. So you had a colleague. A fellow officer and dog.
Canine officer, yeah. In 1978, got killed, yeah, by the locals, the intruders. Some intruders came on base. He chased them in.
Let me ask you this. Had you ever seen a picture of the officer that had been killed?
No. It was 1988, so there was no internet. There was no – you couldn't look up newspapers, you know. So there wasn't really access.
You've like to this day, you've never seen what that officer looked like.
I did see what he looked like, but standing under the light, I couldn't really make out his face. I saw him, I saw the uniform, I saw the dog, and then like in a blink, gone.
He was gone.
Gone. I turned around, I looked at the DOD guard. He's like, "I didn't see anything." Well, and I turn around, gone.
Did it freak out?
And I was
you
like,
out?
"You didn't see someone standing there?" "No, boss. No, boss. I didn't see." He was sleeping. I think he was sleeping, too.
Oh, my God.
So that was when I first started saying, there. I saw a ghost, man. And, yeah, so that's my ghost story. So if you're listening and you like those stories, go to True Hauntings and Scary Stories on any one of your podcast platforms. And check it out, because she does a really good job at what she does with that podcast. And she's a fan of our podcast now.
Yeah, she is. All
she
right.
listened to it, and she said she was cracking up. And she commented on she's vegan, and she commented on the fact that she was mortified when I said I dipped my bologna sandwich in milk.
That's not what should mortify her.
She was mortified.
the eating meat part shouldn't be the part that's scary.
It was the whole thing. So that's my ghost story. And I lived in a haunted house, but that's another time.
Thank you for sharing that story. I'm not sure what it has to do with music, but okay.
Oh, you son of a mother.
I'm just kidding. Jesus. I appreciate you sharing that.
I'm like,
seriously, you couldn't tease that story and not tell it.
No. And so I was thinking she has some pretty good rock and roll ghost stories and encounters.
Really?
Yeah. So maybe
next, I feel a collaboration.
Yeah. Well, maybe
I feel a Harlem Globetrotters hooking up with Scooby-Doo and his crew. Yeah,
there you go.
Meeting of the minds.
I think it would be an interesting show to have her on, and she could tell some rock and roll ghost story encounters that, you know, that rock stars have had and people have had with rock stars. It might be pretty interesting.
It couldn't be any worse than what we do.
You know what? So anyways.
Hey, come on. Sometimes our show is a bit of a horror story.
All right. We're 15 minutes in. We haven't even mentioned. So last week we did David Bowie. And I was talking about David Bowie live at the Tower. And, you know, you were kind of killing it on the quality. It has been remastered. And it does, technology today actually did clean it up a lot. And it has a little more bass to it than the album. But I still love the album, the original version of it.
I was just going to ask you. I mean, you know, sometimes when they remaster things and they try to kind of clean up the mistakes, they almost ruin it a little bit. Like, did you have the same reaction to it? Did you have the same love for it with the new mix?
Well, I'll always love it, but it's embedded in my brain. You know how sometimes albums, like we talked about the Black Crowes, like you hear a little difference if they remake the song, or like you said, sure, that was an alternate version. You all the little nuances, and I listened to that album, as they say, until I wore out the grooves. You know, I just love that album. So listening to the remastered version is still good. It's still a great performance, great songs, great music. The band was in full stride with him. But I still prefer the original just because that's what I listen to the most. But there's a remastered version, so if you ever want to try to check it out, David Live at the Tower in Philadelphia. It's a great thing. Great album, live album, as far as I'm concerned. So, hey, you know, did you know that Taylor Hawkins actually records his own music, the drummer for the Foo Fighters? You know that, yeah.
Sure.
So, sure. I heard a cut from him today. He's a big Stuart Copeland fan. That was very influenced by Stuart Copeland and how he plays, although he does have his own style. But he's also a big Level 42 fan.
Oh my God.
Right? Right? So he loves the 80s. He loves the 80s new wave movement, right? So I'll let you get to this in a minute, what you were gonna say. He did a cover of, and it's just like it was fresh released when I heard it, of Level 42's Something About You. And for the people that don't know,
one big hit.
Yeah, for people that don't know, it's this song. So everybody that grew up in the 80s, I actually love that song. That is still a great song to me. So he did a cover of that. I don't know.
Covers are tricky things, man.
You know how Joan Jett did Crimson and Clover with kind of a reverb in her voice, or it sounded a little deeper and dark? He did that. He doesn't have Joan Jett's voice, but that's kind of how he recorded it. And now the beat is great. You can hear his drumming more pronounced than in the original version, which he's a drummer. If you get a chance to listen to it, let me know what you think. I listened to the whole thing. I didn't turn it off because it's a good song. He did it a little bit of justice, but
Taylor Hawkins is, you know, somebody that can carry a tune a little bit and certainly sing backup vocals. At least in my opinion, he's not a vocalist. He's a drummer.
No. But he's a very rich drummer that can make his own music whenever he wants.
He's a very rich drummer. He's had tremendous success for those of you that are listening that don't know. So, you know, Taylor Hawkins, you know, is the drummer for the Foo Fighters, and Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters kind of stole him.
He stole him outright.
Kind of stole him from Alanis Morissette.
There's no kind of.
Now, if you listen to Dave Grohl's version, he'll say that it was Taylor Hawkins that reached out to him saying, hey, I want to be in your band. And the Foo Fighters were not a big band at the time. They were really just getting started. And Dave Grohl was like, have you not realized that you're in probably the band that has the biggest selling album of like the past 5 years, Jagged Little Pill? Guys are playing huge places. We're playing these tiny little theaters and whatnot. He was like, yeah, but I want to be in a rock band. I want to be in a rock band. What a great move, huh? That took a lot of balls to leave.
He could have took the money and run at the time. Yeah. The easy way out, and he could have been, you know, he could have been a session drummer. He could have joined with somebody else later, but he made the right choice.
He rolled the dice, and now he is a multi millionaire and making his own horrible versions of songs from the 80s.
Exactly. Good dude, though. Good dude. You don't hear him getting in trouble. None of those guys. They're all
he did overdose.
Well, I mean, that's the rock star life, but at least he's not an asshole that overdosed.
But by the way, just for, you know, because you brought it up, Level 42, not that this is remotely interesting, but I got to see them live once. You know who they opened for?
Madonna. I couldn't. Oh, Jesus. Wow.
How's that for a weird mix? I saw them down at Gillette State. Well, it wasn't even Gillette. I think it was Sullivan at the time. Yeah. But Level 42 opened for Madonna. And like, I think it was like 87 or so.
It's about when that song broke. Yeah.
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 Just a weird double bill. You know what I mean?
Well, that was that's the quarter flash syndrome, I call it. We saw Bob Seger at the Boston Garden, and quarter flash opened up for him, and nobody gave a shit about the first 12 songs they sang. They just wanted to hear Hard in My Heart. You know,
I wonder if a few of your stories slightly wrong.
Okay, they maybe didn't back up Bob Seger? Is that what you're saying?
They opened for Elton John when we saw him.
Was it Elton John? See, there you go. Drunk. I think we talked about that. That's right.
Me, you, and Sabby, and I think it was Michael O'Keefe. Four of us on two seats. About nine rows back on the floor.
The good days.
Your typical, we didn't even go together. So I think it was me and Oki that went, we got in our seats and you came walking up like you always did instead of going to your seats, and you saw us, you saw a safe harbor.
I didn't have to muscle my way into those seats.
No, you didn't. You were more than welcome. What a great fucking show. I mean, I've had the pleasure of seeing Elton John a couple of times, but he was never better than he was that night.
Yeah. Yeah. And was that his last show at the Garden, or his second to last show, or what was it?
So that was 82. I think he played the Centrum in 84.
Right.
And I don't think he played the original Garden again. I think, you know, he certainly has played the new Garden a couple times.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So
would you go see Elton John if he came around again?
No.
Why?
No. Just like I have a chance to go see Sting, and I don't know. I saw him when he was right at the tail end of his peak in the early 80s. And I'm just not a big fan of seeing old rock stars who can't sing the way they used to sing. And you're just going to see them just to see them at that point, I think, you know.
So because you mentioned
Sting might be good. I don't know.
I bet you he would be good, but if you don't mind, if I can go down a little bit of a rabbit hole.
Oh, be my guest. It's a mixtape show. So
since you mentioned Sting, so, you know, you talk about, you know, aging rock stars and maybe some of them that are trying to recapture their glory, or maybe they just think that they still have something to offer or something to say. So there's been a couple of releases recently, and there's two of them that I can think of off the top of my head. John Mellencamp put out a new record. But Sting put out a new record as well in the latter part of 2021. Not great.
That's what I mean.
So the John Mellencamp one, he has adopted Tom Waits' singing style.
Oh, boy.
Which may be, you know, a style thing, or it may be a result of the fact that even after, I don't know, three heart attacks, he's still smoking five packs of cigarettes or three packs of cigarettes a day. But his voice is no longer that kind of crooning, you know, Jack and Diane or whatnot. Not that he was a crooner, but his voice is rough.
Yeah.
Sting's voice is more intact. He certainly doesn't have the range that he used to.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, on both of those releases, the thing that strikes me about both of them is that the songwriting is just not nearly what it used to be. You know, there's a almost like your ghost. You can see a faint shadow of what used to be there, but right. it doesn't have the impact that it once did.
And that's, you know, the songwriting thing. We went over that with Aerosmith, right?
Yeah.
And actually, last week I mentioned that Blue Jean is one of my fave David Bowie songs. That was that, off that album, that and Loving the Alien were the only two songs that he wrote by himself on that album. So, maybe you're right. But do they get lazy? Do they get, that maybe they get caught up in the, this guy has the new sound. This guy who writes these songs, and he gets, you know, someone gets hyped up to them, and they're like, okay, write some songs for me. Or they just don't want to write songs anymore, like they used to. They're millionaires 20, 30 times over. They don't have to take the time to sit down and write. I mean, I'm not saying this is every rock star, but I think this goes for a lot of these guys. They're like, I did my time writing. Let someone write for me. I'll just perform now. You know, and yeah, I don't know if there's anything wrong with that.
There may be some truth to that. I'll tell you that there's a part of me that wonders that, you know, if you think about when rock bands first start out, yeah, they're scraping to get by. They're hungry, yeah, right? So yeah, they're having experiences, and they're meeting people, and they're doing all types of things, and it's kind of a rich life. Even though it may be a struggle, there's a lot to draw from, right? Mm-hmm. But then you think about Sting, Elton John, you know, John Mellencamp. Have those guys had a care in the world in the past, you know, 30 or 40 years? They live in an insulated world where, you know, it's, you know, hotel rooms and it's, you know, mansions and it's more money than you've ever dreamed of. I mean, are you still able to kind of like carve out the same interesting content and write from the same place that you once were able to write from?
And some of these people end up having families, and when they're not touring, they're spending time with their families. I'm sure there's a 100 variables that go into, you know, which stars do what, but, you know, where they used to be just them writing songs, trying to get them recorded, and then they get them recorded, then they make it big, and then they're hungry, and then they're not hungry, then they get a family, and do I really want to write all these songs, or do I just want someone to do it for me, and I'll, like Aerosmith, and I'll just tear them up on stage, I'll tear them up in the studio. You know, it's not for the money anymore. Certainly.
Yeah.
You know, like Dave Grohl, I think still is, he's a purist. I believe Dave Grohl is worth like $250 million.
Oh, I believe it.
Oh yeah. But I think he's still a purist at heart. I think he still loves his craft. I think he still writes his own songs. I think he's just that kind of guy that doesn't, and he's married, he's a good family man, well, so we see, and you know.
I think that you bring up an interesting point in that I think one of the great things about Dave Grohl is he's not chasing the latest thing. He does what he does, and that's a bit of a balancing act, right?
The Bee Gees, how great was the Bee Gees album?
Yeah, But you know, there's a couple of things. I mean, like, you know, we've talked about REM and we've talked about U2 ad nauseum, you know, to a certain extent. And both of those bands kind of went off the rails because they were chasing the latest sound.
Yeah.
They were trying
to evolve. Bowie was changing the latest sound.
Yeah. Well, Bowie was always chasing the trends and he had some
Bowie used to be the trend.
And he also failed a bunch of times, you know.
He did before he became David Bowie. He was horrible.
Yeah.
Freaking horrible. Yeah. Did you ever see the original video for Major Tom?
Yes.
For Space Oddity? Sure. Oh, if you haven't seen it, check out the original video for David Bowie's Space Oddity. It's hideous. It's cringy.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the extreme other side of not trying to evolve and change and keep up with the times into, you know, bringing a new audience is obvious, is like the Ramones. They never really changed their sound. And, you know, it's one of those tough situations that if they had tried to put out something different, they probably would have been ridiculed for it.
Well, that's a band that had a very distinct and particular sound. They were not by any means diverse in their music, you know? So if they, like you said, if they ever tried to slow it down, well, that's like when Sid Vicious did the recording of My Way, right?
Yeah.
It's almost comical, but he, you know, he took a chance. It's actually pretty funny. But yeah, so you're going to get those people that, like, they can't change their sound. They're locked in, you know? Like, Blondie had at least three different sounds, the group. They were diverse. They could roll around. They could move around because they did it early. Yeah. Elvis Costello, who, I mean, I love Elvis too. By the way, one of the best of albums, or CDs, or downloads you can get is Elvis Costello's Greatest Hits.
Fantastic, that's a, right?
Oh, man.
Absolutely
fantastic. So good.
But you run the risk. You know, like Elvis Costello, he did his chamber music thing. He did his thing with Burt Bacharach. He did his thing where he explored jazz. He did his thing where he explored, you know, kind of the bebop thing, which is great. You know, and I'm sure it kept it interesting for him. And he was able to pop out some hits here and there. But as a listener, especially if you're a passive fan, and I think we kind of talked about this. I had the opportunity to see him a handful of months ago. He played here in Portsmouth. And there were probably 95% of the audience that just wanted him to play the record that you just mentioned. They wanted to hear Greatest Hits.
Yeah.
And Elvis Costello, he plays what he wants to play. Which means that you alienate a percentage of your audience for a percentage of the show.
So let me ask you this. Then is it a case of they get so rich that now it doesn't matter about the fans? I'm going, and we talked about this in one of our earliest episodes. I'm rich now, so I'm just going to write what I want to write. And, you know, if it sells, it sells. If it doesn't, oh well. But I wrote it. I put an album together that I wanted to put together, and it bombs.
I think you're right in that if they're financially sound, it allows them to say, look, I don't have to go out and do my fucking greatest hits.
Right.
And by the way, I'm Elvis Costello, and I've played Allison and Watching the Detectives and What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding 300 billion fucking times. If I'm going to go out on tour, I need to be able to find my creative juices and feed my creative juices by doing a mix. Look, I'll play some of the songs to keep the audience happy, but I got to keep myself happy as well.
Morrissey, like I'd said a number of times, Morrissey does that. He has more than double the albums that the Smiths had as a solo career.
Yeah.
Why would he put himself in a box and just sing Smith songs, then just don't make albums. Don't be creative. And he's had some kerplunkers as far as album sales go. The dude does not stay with a record label long. whether he can't stand them or they can't stand him, or he's one album now lately and done. Like, he's like, nah, I'm moving on, because he can. And he's not, by any means, a Dave Grohl. Like, Morrissey might be worth, I don't know, $15 million. If you look, and that's a lot to you and I, but if you look in the big picture of rock and roll and music in general, there's, you know, fucking Billy Squire could be worth $9 million. Not too far off.
I'm surprised, and I'm sure you've done your research, but I'm surprised that Morrissey's worth that little.
Well, you got to think the Smiths are a very, they're a very particular band with a particular sound. It's to me that they're my favorite group. They're just fantastic. The Smiths albums, Morrissey has a particular sound that isn't always. It's not mainstream. He never really went mainstream. Now, he could have if he wanted to, but he marches to the beat of his own drummer. He does what he wants to do. And listen, how much money do you really need, right? Yet, if you're worth $15 million and it's solid money, it's not, you know, it's I have money coming in. Some people are like, I'm good. I'm fucking good. You know, I don't have to be worth $100 million. You know, but hey, who's known as the father of rock and roll? Ooh,
the father of rock and roll.
Yeah,
the father of rock and roll. Is it a performer?
Yeah. Right.
This is all right. I'm gonna take a guess.
Give it to me. Come on, you can do it.
I'm gonna roll
a hard eight now, buddy. A hard eight. Come on.
I have to think that this is wrong, but I'm gonna say Louis Jordan.
Nah.
Give me a little hint.
Okay. He's a solo guitar player. He's a solo act that plays guitar.
Les Paul.
Nope. He's been around, or he was around 50s, 60s, 70s. Very influential.
I have a couple of people that are going through my head. I mean, I could say maybe Muddy Waters.
No, same color.
Not Chuck Berry.
Bingo. Yeah.
Oh, shit.
The guy that punked you. You got punked, which is a pretty, that's a pretty big honor. Chuck Berry punked you.
Chuck Berry pushed me out of the way.
I love that story.
Yeah, I mean, come on, man. So do I. Although, let me just say for the record, in just defense of myself, is that Chuck Berry certainly deserves that honor. I would never take anything away from
him.
But the simple fact is that if you listen to Louis Jordan, Chuck Berry stole a lot from Louis Jordan.
I can't argue with you because I'm not versed on Louis Jordan, but I'll take your word for it.
I probably should have guessed that right at the outset. And I have to say that I wholeheartedly agree with it. You don't have Chuck Berry. You don't have a lot of the rest of it.
That's right. And I loved Chuck Berry when I was a kid. I had his 8-track. I've said this before, a live recording of his 8-track. I used to love Chuck Berry, but everybody did.
Well, one of the things that I loved about Chuck Berry is that, you know, never mind great guitar player, you know, some great songs and, you know, instant hooks and those leads that he played and whatnot. But when he was on stage and when he was on TV, he was funny and witty and charming and just looked really approachable. And in public, he was a giant fucking asshole. And I loved it.
Hey, you know who didn't like Chuck Berry?
Who didn't like Chuck Berry?
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Why didn't Jerry Lee Lewis like Chuck Berry?
He was forced to play back. Like, he was opening. He got forced to open for Chuck Berry.
Oh, there you go. Now you know why he doesn't like him.
Well, he went to the extent of he did his performance, and Jerry Lee was an absolute madman. And after the performance, and you see it in the movie, he lights the piano on fire while he's playing Great Balls of Fire and walks off with the piano in flames. And they had to clear the building. Chuck Berry never got to play. Didn't like that he was opening for Chuck Berry.
Well, you know what? Look, I will tell you this, and not that I'm putting myself in the same category. I certainly am not. But one of the things that I have learned, you know, trying to learn how to paint and kind of interacting with artists, like you would think just instinctively that, you know, art, whether it's music or whether it's painting, or whether it's drawing or whatnot, that there's kind of a lovey-dovey, hippie, kumbaya, you know, we're all making music, we're all painting and whatnot. I will tell you that even in the circle that I run in terms of painters, people backstab each other. It's very, very competitive.
Competitive, yeah.
And I would imagine that there's that same element when it comes to music. One story that is somewhat related was I was always stymied by the fact that Kurt Cobain of Nirvana always said that he hated Pearl Jam. And he never really gave any reason for it. He just, like, I remember there was one interview where he was just like, you know, they were asking him about Eddie Vedder, and he was like, you know, he seems like a nice guy. I've spoken to him a couple of times. He was like, but I've always hated that band. And it wasn't until after he died and somebody was interviewing Courtney Love, and Courtney Love kind of put it out there and said they were rivals because they were competitors. You know, they got lumped in together, right, wrong, or indifferent, because they were both part of the grunge scene. But, you know, they kind of the press kind of pitted them against one another. But at least according to Courtney Love, to the degree that you believe her, she said that there was some jealousy there.
Oasis and Blur.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
so
Oasis and Blur was a huge, huge battle.
So I'm not suggesting that there weren't incidents or there weren't personality conflicts between Jerry Lee Lewis and Chuck Berry. But I would venture to guess that there was a little competition in terms of who's the top of the heap. Who's the father of rock and roll?
Right.
Because I bet in Jerry Lee Lewis's camp and in his own mind, it ain't Chuck Berry.
Who's Richard Wayne Pennyman?
That is Little Richard.
If you had a chance to see either Little Richard or Jerry Lee Lewis, who would you go see in their prime, in their heyday?
So I saw both of them in the 80s.
I'm talking in the 50s when they were dominators.
Yeah. I think I would have to go with Little Richard.
See, and that's where we always live. I'd have to go with Jerry Lee Lewis.
Why? Why?
Little
Richard, come on.
I love the fact that Jerry Lee Lewis was a fucking loose cannon. He's my kind of guy. He was unpredictable. He was absolutely insane. Little Richard was.
He married his 13-year-old cousin.
Well, aside from all that.
Jerry Lee Lewis was a bad boy.
I just think he must have put on one fucking hell of a show. He was controlled, like chaos on stage. It was probably more choreographed. I think Jerry Lee was just in the moment every moment he was on stage.
Yeah. This feeds into our previous conversation, in that Jerry Lee Lewis, as his career progressed, his sound evolved. He actually went country.
Yeah.
In the 70s, right? And so that's where I lose Jerry Lee Lewis. And my dad was a big Jerry Lee Lewis fan, and he played all of that country stuff, and it drove me crazy being a, you know, 13-year-old Kiss, Van Halen, soon to be Ramones fan. Little Richard never evolved.
No, yeah, in the 60s, he went, you look out, look at his discography. You see, you know, some Christian albums.
That's a little bit different. He didn't go gospel to evolve his sound. He renounced rock and roll. He found religion.
But nonetheless, so, he changed his style.
Yeah, but in terms of, you know, putting out popular music, Jerry Lee Lewis, he certainly had a much richer career because he evolved. Where Jerry, I mean, where Little Richard, he, you know, followed his faith, you know, hey, more power to him and whatnot. But his music didn't necessarily evolve.
While he was doing that, and I think it was around 1962, a concert promoter named Don Arden, he persuaded him to do a tour of Europe, Little Richard. The Beatles opened for him. And he was the that was where he advised the Beatles on how to sing his songs, how to sing the type. He trained Paul to those high sounds.
Whoa.
There we go. I knew it. I had the only way I could fucking describe it. I was waiting for it. I said, right before I said, he's going to go, whoa, wait a minute.
Whoa. Can you just do that one more time? Hey, it's a ghost.
But that's where, you know, and he was actually pretty, he was the reason that concerts started becoming desegregated.
Desegregated,
yeah. They used to be segregated. But he had a huge impact on that. He was so prominent in his music that Elvis, Buddy Holly, Bill Haley, Jerry Lee, your boys, the Everly Brothers, ugh. Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran all covered his songs, Little Richard's songs.
Sure.
Elvis had four of his songs on his first two albums, the big breakthrough albums. He actually said that Little Richard in 1969, Elvis proclaimed, Little Richard is the greatest ever. He even better than him. When the king bows to you, that says a lot. So
he was
very influential.
He was a performer.
He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 86 as one of the originals, right? He was also inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. He was a recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Recording Academy and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. In 2015, he received a Rhapsody in Rhythm Award from the National Museum of African American Music for his key role in the formulation of popular music genres and helping bring an end to racial divide in the music charts, not in concerts, in the music charts. And Tutti Frutti was included in the National Recording Registry in the Library of Congress. So that man left his mark. He unfortunately left us in 2020. But the interesting thing about Little Richard, he had a huge resurgence in the 80s.
Sure.
He was everywhere.
Yeah.
He came out as commercials,
movies.
Just absolutely embraced that whole, what would you call it? That whole, they call it today non-binary, but that kind of, is he gay? Is he not gay? Is flamboyant? But nobody cared. Like, because he was Little Richard. Yep. Makeup caked on, the black eyeliner around his eyes, hair all done back. He basically said, this is it, I'm sure. This is my last money grab. That dude was everywhere in the 80s.
When you were doing your research, did you happen to look up what his net worth was when he passed?
No, I didn't. No, but I'm sure.
I wonder if it was more than Morrissey's.
Oh, I'm sure Little Richard has a. What are you doing over there, buddy? Jeez.
Oh, nothing. Don't pay attention to me.
Don't pay attention to that man behind the microphone in New Hampshire. So what do you got? What do you got for me? Anything?
Well, I guess, you know, the big question that I have for you, and I have a couple of things that I want to talk about, but the biggest thing, well, the thing that's top of mind right now is, what did you think of the Super Bowl halftime performance?
Little Richard, when he died, was worth $40 million.
And you're saying that Morrissey is worth $15
million? No, I was only saying that. Morrissey's probably up around the same in that area.
I bet you Morrissey is worth $75 million. That's my guess.
Well, that's the beauty of the internet, isn't it? Let's see. Give me 10 seconds on this, and we will get an estimate. The halftime show, I liked it. Morrissey net worth. Oh, okay. I was kind of off. Morrissey's net worth at 2022 is estimated to be worth $118 million. I was only off by $100
million. That's all.
Morrissey. I like the halftime show.
So it's been, kind of an interesting thing. First and foremost, I will agree with you. I thought that it was fantastic. You know, really liked it, a little bit different. I thought it was well done. It wasn't too crazy over the top. So here's the controversy around it. And there is plenty of controversy around it. And I think some of it I can address, and some of it I'm curious to hear what your take is on it. So, you know, overall, I thought it was very entertaining. I thought it was very well done. Different style of music. So on Facebook and some of the other social media, when Monday morning rolled around, you had plenty of people that said that was the worst fucking halftime show ever. Now, there was some commonality, at least in my opinion, to the people that were saying that it was the worst halftime show. And most of them, they weren't hip hop fans.
No.
You know, they still talk, call it rap, and they say rap is crap and whatnot. And they, just don't embrace that. And hey, If that's not your thing, I get it. But one of the things that I had written, just because I wanted to mix it up a little bit, is I was like, look, man, just because you don't like rap, it doesn't mean that it sucked, as you say that it sucked. You, if you were a vegetarian and you went to somebody's house for a dinner party and all they served was Texas barbecue, you can leave there saying, wow, that was lousy. I didn't have a good time. But it doesn't mean that the ribs were any less tasty.
Exactly.
So, I get that. It's not your thing. And, sometimes people aren't as open-minded. Well, so the second reason why people kind of called it is that there was a good call out from a cross section of people that were accusing the performers, at least to a certain extent, of lip syncing.
Of course. You have to.
And I think that, part of that is the production, and part of it is the logistics and whatnot. Even our good friend Tal, talked about, hey, I hope you enjoyed the lip syncing. Didn't bother me nearly as much. It would bother me if I went and paid for a ticket to specifically see them and they lip sync. That would really disappoint me. But, TV performance, you can go back in time, Whitney Houston doing... is it the national anthem that she did?
Yeah.
That they found out that she had actually lip synced it. She performed it live, but she during the
you
actual
have
live
to lip
sync
it. You have to. You can't. You're not going to get pure sound with all those people there.
Yeah, I don't know.
Did like the girl that lip-sync? Did the girl
did,
that
did Springsteen
the...
lip sync? Did Petty lip sync? Did Prince lip sync when they?
So look at the difference. But look at the difference in. Who are you talking about? You got a rock band, right? So there's a lot going on there. There's a lot of sound coming out of them, right? A lot of stuff can be covered up. And it's pretty hard to not notice if, little Steven isn't strumming the guitar in the right way, But when you have solo performers, like the girl that did God Bless America, that was lip-synced all the way up to the last moment when she said, thank you. You heard the difference in the sound of what she was singing, and when she finished, like the last 7 seconds of it, how many people were at that stadium? 80,000,
probably, right? Somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah. So how many people were watching? 80 million.
Sure.
So who are you going to perform for? The 80,000 there or the 80 million watching around the world? You don't want anything to go wrong. Somebody's voice cracks and it's a horrible performance. Give the people watching it, put on the show, because it's called the halftime show, not the halftime concert. There's a difference, right? So,
did you know that those performers, in all of the performers that do the halftime show, that they don't really get paid?
Oh, I mean, you're not going to get any better publicity than doing a halftime show.
Yeah, I think that's what they bank on.
You got everybody's attention.
At least what I've read is that the performers either don't get paid or they get paid union scale, whatever that is, you know, but it's not a lot. I think the more disgraceful thing is like all of the dancers that they had on the field, $15 an hour.
Just happy to be on the field, though.
Yeah.
Just happy to be down there.
It's an experience. It's something
in the moment.
You put on your resume experience. And, you know, whatnot.
Dude, I was an extra, and I was an extra when I was stationed in Southern California. I was an extra on some TV shows, ER and NYPD Blue. You think I got paid a lot of money? No, but it was fucking great being on the set, dressed as fucking Officer O'Malley from the Chicago Police Department. You know?
Man, can we actually see you on screen?
It's not like a lot because I really saw how they control these things. Even on a street scene, there's an assistant director somewhere with five people saying, okay, walk. Just walk that. And they walk the way they're told to walk. And the number one thing is do not look at the camera. Sure. So ever since I did those extras in these TV shows, I watch the extras in the background. Every time I watch a movie, I watch a show, and they're in a bar, I'm watching the extras because an extra's thing is to try to get your face on the screen. It is the unwritten. Everybody tries it. No one talks about it. They try to turn their head, like they angle their bodies. You see the fake conversations, the hand movements. It's pretty amusing when you really see it in play. But I had fun doing it, and I got like $15 an hour, you know?
Yeah. It's the experience.
It's the experience. They'll never do that again.
So before we leave this topic entirely, the third controversy that is surrounding the performance right now is the whole police thing. And I'm curious, especially given your background, what your opinion is on the lyrics. I think both Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg kind of putting down the police. And then on top of it, you know, you had Eminem that took a knee during the performance.
Didn't even notice that. What didn't know until you just told me that.
Yeah, it's been floating around, and
I think people are looking for stuff. Listen, Snoop Dogg's breakout song was with Dr. Dre. Dr. Dre found Snoop Dogg through his half brother Warren G. Warren G was friends with Snoop Dogg. Snoop Dogg had a demo. Dr. Dre listened to it and said, this dude's got, he's got something, a unique sound. So they did the song Deep Cover for the movie with Lawrence Fishburne, Deep Cover. And the song is 187 on an undercover cop. 187 is code for murder, right? So that can't, and you know what? I don't care. I was a cop. I like the song. I don't take lyrics literally. He's telling a story in the song. Right? And it followed the movie, by the way, Deep Cover. So they've been talking about that. Listen, I like Ice-T. But him and Body Count saying Cop Killer, right? Now there's a lot of people that just look for shit like that because, number one, they don't like rap. They don't like hip-hop, right? So they're going to look for shit to complain about it. Instead of just letting it go, you know, the biggest controversy in the history of hip hop was Fuck the Police by NWA. But kids were saying that in Compton before they made that song, you know, in South Central, they were saying that in Roxbury in Boston. They were saying that on the mean streets of Dover, New Hampshire. They were saying that.
Well, I think that you and I share this opinion in that, you know, whether they're actually expressing their opinion about the police, or if it's Bruce Springsteen or Eddie Vedder or U2 in terms of talking about their political affiliations or complaining about Donald Trump or George Bush or whoever it is. I'm like, do you really think that I get my political advice and influence from fucking Bono or Eddie Vedder?
Right.
I'm smart enough to make my own decisions. I take what I want from this music and I discard the rest.
I raised my kids in the 90s. I'd have everything from Marilyn Manson to Public Enemy to the Rolling Stones on a CD, right? And I always told my kids, because that was when Marilyn Manson was the devil. And, you know, he played it for all he could. He got all the publicity he ever wanted. I mean, I tell them it's just music. It's just lyrics.
Where do you land or stand on, you know, we're talking about the controversy of the Super Bowl halftime show. What about the controversy that's surrounding Marilyn Manson right now? Do you have an opinion on that? I mean, there's a lot of stories out there. There was a big expose in Rolling Stone magazine, and he's being sued by a number of women that he abused them physically and verbally over a period of time. I'm not minimizing the trauma or drama that they were exposed to and whatnot. But there's a part of me that's like, are you fucking surprised? It's Marilyn Manson. This is what he does. This is who he is, and this is who he's been for a long period of time. There was a blurring of the lines between, what's his real name, Brian Warner?
Something like that, yeah.
Brian Warner and Marilyn Manson, those lines crossed and got blurred many, many years ago when he started living up to his persona.
Yeah.
So, you know, but again, I'm not dismissing it. I'm not minimizing it or whatnot, no. But I'm not friggin' surprised by it in the least.
No, sensitive issue. No matter what you say, you're going to get somebody's going to criticize you. So all I'll say is this. Listen. Shit happens 15 years ago. And that's always the question, right? Why are you bringing it up now, 15 years later, when you didn't? And this is where it gets, you know, I'm not making any decision either way, but that's the criticism that unfortunately women have to face when they bring up an issue 15 years later, 20 years later.
No, you're getting into a dangerous area. Maybe we should talk about the Everly Brothers for a
while. Yeah, exactly. I don't really, I don't pay much attention to that stuff. I don't, whatever. If the dude fucked up and he gets in trouble, then he gets in trouble. I'm not going to lose my mind over it. And if he did something wrong and he deserves to be punished, then punish him. You know, yeah. I'm not defending anybody.
Nope.
But I thought the funniest thing I thought about the halftime show was the only other white guy on the stage other than Eminem was the tuba player.
So, you know, I'll tell you the thing.
I was like, I got the tuba player. He's the only one. And I didn't care that it was all. I'm like, hey, listen, it's LA. It's the NFL's been pushing that. But the tuba player.
I'll tell you that, you know, people watching that halftime show, there were some people that were saying that was great. There were some people that were saying, man, I wish, that was garbage. I wish they had anybody else out there. And there was one person that was down at Fox with his friends going, I wonder if they're using this as the launching pad to actually do a big tour. Because there have been bands like The Who and, you know, Tom Petty and I think even Maroon 5 that use their Super Bowl performance to kind of, as their launching pad, that, you know, a day or a week later that they actually announced that they were doing this big stadium tour or whatnot. And I have to tell you, there was a big part of me saying, man, if Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg and Kendrick Lamar and Mary J. Blige and Eminem did a big tour, I would absolutely go to that.
Don't forget my man 50.
Yeah,
Curtis.
I think that would be a hell of a fun show to go to.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Did you notice that they were pretty much some of the commercials and that halftime show was geared toward people that grew up in the 90s?
Sure.
Right? The people that now have disposable income.
That's right.
You know, so I think they did a good job. Listen, if you don't like this, there's people that when Prince played and considered maybe one of the greatest halftime shows ever, and they don't like Prince. You know, you get people that hate you too. And when they put on one of the greatest and most patriotic shows in the history of the Super Bowl. People that didn't like that. There's always going to be people. But I just hate the fact
you,
that.
How can you have an Irish band play an American? The Super Bowl's for Americans.
Listen, when he opened that jacket ridiculous. And he had the American flag on it as the lining of his jacket. Come on, man. I got goosebumps right now just thinking about that. When he opened that jacket and there's the American, that was just pure fucking class. That was a moment right there.
Hey, you know what? Whether you liked it or not, you know, they could easily go back to the first, almost 20 years of the NFL where all they had was fucking marching bands.
Yeah. And look how much marching bands have advanced since back then. I mean, this competition, I think we're getting out of the music genre now, but let me ask you this.
Do you think if you were to actually rank, do you think that this Super Bowl halftime show was top five, top 10? Not neither.
I don't really rank them too much. I mean, they were better than Maroon 5.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I didn't think it was such a bad performance, but
yeah, you've had some pretty prominent people. So I actually looked up. So, you know, going back to 1991, which is really where they started introducing popular music to the halftime show of the Super Bowl. 91, New Kids on the Block. 92, Gloria Estefan. 93, Michael Jackson. 94, Clint Black, Tanya Tucker, Travis Tritt, and the Judds. 95, Patti LaBelle, Teddy Pendergrass, Tony Bennett, Arturo Sandoval, and the Miami Sound Machine. 1996, Diana Ross. 1997, the Blues Brothers with ZZ Top and James Brown, which Rolling Stone regards as one of the worst performances at a Super Bowl halftime show. In 98, they did a tribute to Motown, who was celebrating the 40th anniversary with Boyz II Men, Smokey Robinson, Martha Reeves, The Temptations, Queen Latifah. 1999, Gloria Estefan again, Stevie Wonder, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. 2000, Phil Collins, Christina Aguilera, and Toni Braxton. 2001, which most people think 2001 was U2, but it wasn't. It was actually Aerosmith and NSYNC. It wasn't until 2002.
That was U2 a bad pairing. Played. I remember that. That was not taken well. Aerosmith and NSYNC.
With Britney Spears as well.
Oh, that was not taken well. They jumped the shock on that one, buddy.
Yeah, they did.
Fucking
2003, Shania Twain and No Doubt. 2004, Jessica Simpson, Janet Jackson, P. Diddy, Nelly, Kid Rock, and Justin Timberlake.
I remember
nobody
that one.
Nobody remembers that Jessica Simpson, P. Diddy, and Nelly were even there.
Right.
2005, Paul McCartney. 2006, The Rolling Stones. 2007, Prince. 2008, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. 2009, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. 2010, The Who, which a lot of people regard as one of the poorer performances.
Yeah.
2011, The Black Eyed Peas with Usher and Slash. 2012, Madonna. 2013, Beyonce with Destiny's Child. 2014, The Red Hot Chili Peppers, which, by the way, not a great live band.
No.
They're hit or miss.
Yeah.
They're hit or miss. 2015, Katy Perry. 2016, Coldplay, who a lot of people regard as not being able to carry it. So that's why they actually had Bruno Mars, Beyonce, and Mark Ronson come out.
And Bruno Mars did a fantastic job.
He's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I think one of the greater performances, 2017, Lady Gaga, which was
extraordinary. Yep, she did well.
2018, Justin Timberlake.
Always entertaining. Justin Timberlake's a very entertaining guy. Yeah.
2019 Maroon 5. I'm sorry, I don't think Maroon 5 has got the stature to really earn their way into.
Now, weren't they like a last minute thing? There was some reason they got pulled into that.
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy with the whole Colin Kaepernick issue. So there was a lot of tension, and there were, I think, and I don't know if this is true. I'd have to go back and look at it, but I think that they actually had other people that they were considering. For that show that people either passed on it or pulled out.
Yeah. There was something so why think, they ended Maroon up doing
found,
it.
Maroon 5 found their way into that. So 2020, Shakira and Jennifer Lopez. 2021.
Now, Shakira and Jennifer Lopez, let me comment on that one. It was.
Sure.
Now, Shakira, always good to look at in my eyes. She's always good to look at. Jennifer Lopez, The girl, her, she's like Raquel Welch. She's timeless. She does not age roughly. She ages very gracefully. And but the thing about those shows is Shakira did hers first. Jennifer Lopez did second. And it was the fucking almost an identical show. Yeah. They had the same amount of dancers. They had the same. It was like, didn't I just see a few little differences, but didn't I see Shakira's show do the same thing? I don't know. But they were both good to look at.
Yeah, and you know what? I thought it was a pretty good performance. It was entertaining. Yeah. Is it my type of music? Not really. But I know what? I can get behind it. Hey, you know what? You're not going to like everything that they're going to put on. You know, take it for what it's worth and just try to enjoy it a little bit.
Look, you're eating a fucking bowl of chili. You're sucking down fucking hot dogs. You're drinking beer. What the hell else? What else you got to do? Just watch the freaking show.
Yeah, and shut the fuck up.
Yeah, you know, and I'm just going to say it. I'm just going to put it out there. A lot of white America, and I am by no means a liberal. I'm not going in that direction. It's just the way I see it, the way I call it. A lot of white America had a problem that it was the show was a black halftime show, and I didn't agree with that. I saw all sorts of comments. I actually deleted one of my posts, one of my comments during the halftime show, because it started getting a little out of hand. I'm like, fucking come on, man. Like, know who you're fucking commenting on, number one. Like, I'm not that guy. So don't jump in with both feet, like, with these little racial undertones. I'm the wrong fucking white guy to do that to. I really didn't like that. And that was the underlying thing that nobody wanted. That's what they say, the 5,000-pound elephant in the room. No one really wanted to say it, but I'm saying it. I think a lot of white America had a problem that the halftime show was all black, and it was all hip-hop. And they, you know, and they just took umbrage to it. You know, and so what? You know what? Do you think the black people or the Latinos that were watching back when Bruce Springsteen was playing was like, well, what is this? Why is it an all white band?
You know, they may have given Bruce a pass.
Well, because Clarence Clemens was there, so he brought it right. He made it right.
Well, I
the big man.
Everybody probably gave Bruce Springsteen in the E Street Band.
I'm just using that as a
boss. But you have to imagine that there were people scratching their heads when they were watching Maroon 5.
Oh, it was rather amusing. It was when Adam Levine, I think he took his shirt off. And the first thing I said was, damn, that motherfucker got some abs.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does.
Like, I'm mad enough to admit it. Oh, yeah, dude, he fucking ripped.
So just so we can finish the list. So in 2021, The Weeknd played. So as we had talked about before, the NFL does not pay the performers to play. And I think they do get some budget for production. But in 2021, The Weeknd actually put up, I think, somewhere between $7 and $9 million of his own money to see through his vision of what that performance would be.
Okay, so you had Dr. Dre. I don't care if you're white, black, yellow, whatever. Everybody knows who Dr. Dre is, right? One of the greatest record producers ever. One of the most popular record producers. You had Eminem. Everybody fucking knows who that is, right? You had Mary J. Blige. A big chunk of people know who she is, right? You had Snoop Dogg. Come on, the dude did a cookbook with Martha Stewart, right? Everybody, he's in every commercial now, which I love the fact that he does what I love to do, flops and socks. Drives people crazy, but... And so you got all these, and so those are names. I remember last year people going, who the fuck is The Weeknd?
Yeah.
Like, where the fuck did he come from? Like, what is The Weeknd? Is it a group? And it's a guy who calls himself The Weeknd. And where has The Weeknd been since then? Really?
Well, I don't know the reason behind this, but I know that he was scheduled to play two nights at the Garden and they got canceled. So I don't know. Yeah.
Ticket sales, maybe.
It may be. You know, he may have kind of.
He was in it for a hot minute, and that's it.
Yeah, he doesn't have the deep enough catalog to carry it off. Maybe he got too big. Maybe, you know, it was just a timing thing and there was nobody else that stepped up or whatnot. But I, you know, when I first heard that The Weeknd was playing the Super Bowl, I was like, geez, you know, it seems like there are certainly more prominent people that could be or should be playing that. But, you know, fine. That's cool. Whatever. You know, it's all,
The Weeknd's good in a festival, like in a festival environment.
Ultimately, you know, black, white, hip hop, country, rock, aging rock star, people that are non-Americans or whatnot. You know, when you have an event like that, there's just no way that you're going to make everybody happy. And with social media, you're going to have people that are going to use that forum to complain. And in my opinion, I think 90% of them make themselves look like asses.
Look, at that halftime show brought me back to the 90s when I was stationed in Northern California, then I was stationed in Southern California. That shit was breaking there before it made it to the East Coast. So I was there when all that shit fell, you know, when it dropped. And I liked it. I always liked hip-hop. I liked it back to the 80s when we had Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five and, you know, go beyond that. But I liked it, so it's because I like that music. If you don't like the music, then you didn't like the performance. But don't turn around and say, it's too black. I don't want to hear that shit.
Yeah. Hey, so let me
go ahead.
I was going to say, let me just jump subjects because we're an hour and 15, 16 minutes in and great conversation and whatnot. But I think we would be remiss if we did not at least take a couple of seconds to pay homage and to recognize the passing of one of the great soul and funk legends who never really got her due. And you know who I'm talking about, right?
I don't know. I haven't.
Betty Davis died last week.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Betty Davis died last week.
Oh, if you've never heard her.
Second wife of Miles Davis. She put out three records. None of them were really commercially popular.
No, but I have two of them, and I'll tell you what. And I talked about her at one of the earlier episodes.
Right.
That girl was fucking fire. She was fire. And that was one independent woman, whether she was black or white. That girl did not bend to anybody. She was going to write her own music. She wasn't going to be produced and put up on a pedestal. That girl came from nothing. And then she smokes it, and she said, they asked her why she kept Miles Davis's last name. She said, because I fucking earned it being married to him. That's what she said. I fucking earned it being married to him.
For all of you guys and gals that are listening out there, you more than likely all have either Amazon Prime or Spotify or iTunes or Apple Play or whatever it is. Do yourself a favor. Break out of what you've been listening to for however long you've been listening to it and put on the Betty Davis, the first record. And I think that if you give it, listen to it two or three times, I think you will be absolutely blown away at how powerful and how amazing that record is. Unsung hero, underrated or whatnot. Here it is.
This song's called FUNK. It's off the Nasty Gal album.
F U N K Funk. Funk, yeah. Funk. Wow, help me, nigga, now, help me. I was born with fear.
She was raw, man, and she didn't do many concerts, but there's a little footage out there, and when she did a show, she owned it. That woman, and then she just disappeared.
Yeah.
Fell off the map, said, you know what?
I'll say it again. You know, we know that you guys listen in to be entertained and whatnot, but this is one area where you are definitely being educated, and I think you'll open up a whole new world if you take just a little bit of time to listen to some of those records. Really great stuff, and it's unfortunate that she didn't get her due.
Well, she could have, but she elected to just stay. There's a good documentary on her. She elected to just stay in the shadow. She she had had it with the music business. She was she influenced Jimi Hendrix. She used to hang out with Hendrix over in England. Like, this girl was not, like, stuck in America. She was wanted. She was known by the industry. And that, if just a unique sound, raw, in the band that played with her, fucking phenomenal players, all of them. They were all top-notch funk players from the, some from the Bay Area. She was the queen of funk, absolutely. But then she just walked away, man. Walked. She could have made it, but she, like, I'm done with this.
As I am hoping to do with this podcast at some point, to just
we are away. At our mark. We've been stretching it out because people have actually said to me that they would rather hear us do a little longer than leave stuff on the table. So we aim to please, and Jack is a very, very early bird, and I always appreciate his time. That's why we start now earlier than at 7:30 instead of 8 o'clock. We get in all that extra time. So, Jack, you know what time it is? I know you know what time it is, buddy.
It's nighty-night time. Goodbye, everybody.
Hold on, real quick. This Day in Music on 1974. Holy shit.
No.
Yeah, winners in the UK Music Weekly Disc Readers Award poll. Top UK group went to Slade. Top, and this is 74. Top musician, Roy Wood. David Bowie won the UK and World Male Singer. World Male Singer. With the top single, Gene Genie, and the album with Aladdin Sane. Top female singer was Lindsay DePaul. And Brightest Hope was won by David Essex. Rock on. In 1982, The Jam, with the great Peter Weller, were number one on the UK single charts with A Town Called Malice and Precious.
Paul Weller. Paul Weller, you goddamn dipshit. Hey. Paul, what, Peter Weller. Are you fucking kidding me?
What? I mean, Peter Weller. Peter, I got it right here. I just misread it. It's Peter Weller.
Paul. It's Paul, you
It's Paul Weller. Whatever it is. Hey, listen, sometimes I make mistakes. I was in a hurry.
You know what month Paul Weller was born in?
February. Yeah. Hey, did you like the Style Council?
Love the Style Council.
Talk about jumping into a whole new look, a whole new sound, right?
Yeah.
In 1985, Bruce Springsteen went to number one in the UK album chart with Born in the USA, his first UK number one, blah, blah, blah. In 1991, The Simpsons were at number one in the UK singles charts with Do the Bartman. You know who wrote that song?
Prince.
Michael Jackson. He wrote that. In 2005, Kid Rock was arrested for allegedly punching a DJ at a strip club in Nashville, Tennessee. Police were called to the incident.
That doesn't sound like Kid Rock. That doesn't sound like something he'd do.
Police were called to the incident, but Rock escaped from the club. Shortly after, he was pulled over by an officer who got an autograph but did not do a breathalyzer despite smelling alcohol. The officer has since been fired. The star was eventually arrested a few hours later, taken to night court, and released on $3,000 bail. Born on this day in 1935, Sonny Bono. Born on this day in 1959, my man Ice-T, New Jack Hustler. And in 1961, Andy Taylor from Duran Duran. And that's the show, folks. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. You guys are the engine that makes this machine run. We appreciate your time. We appreciate your input. Without you, it would just be me and Jack talking and doing this podcast for you people.
We would do it anyway. We would talk without you. We don't need you, goddamn audience.
It would run up my minutes on my flip phone. Doing this show for you, to quote my favorite artist, Morrissey, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. And Jack's. And again, we will be back next week with maybe ghost stories. And again, once again, whoever's listening all the way to the end, I want you to go check out the podcast called True Hauntings and Scary Stories with Cynthia Sayre. And we might have her on to tell some rock and roll horror stories next week or the week after. And on that note, Jack, stay on. I'm going to end the stream. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening.
Good night, everybody.
Share this podcast. Thank you.